I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, Global Concern. Russian President Vladimir Putin begins his two-day trip to North Korea. We have analysis on the worldwide implications. Border battle. President Joe Biden celebrates the anniversary of a landmark bill regarding immigration. We're at the White House. Catholic bishops in court. A judge issues an initial ruling in a pro-life lawsuit from the USCCB. And a story that's been buried. Learn more about three people buried alongside dozens of popes at St. Peter's Basilica. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us. Our top story tonight, President Joe Biden unveils a new plan today to help hundreds of thousands of illegal immigrants to gain U.S. citizenship. Critics believe the election year move is designed to win votes and to smooth some bitterness from another recent announcement involving immigration. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
That's right, Tracy. The Biden administration's announcement today comes just 2 weeks after it unveiled an asylum crackdown at the U.S.-Mexico southern border, a move that angered many.
In the East Room, marking the 12th anniversary of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program, President Joe Biden lays out his new plan.
In fact, polls show over 70% of Americans support this effort to keep families together.
The administration will allow certain spouses of U.S. citizens without legal status to apply for permanent residency and eventually citizenship.
These couples have been raising families, sending their kids to church and school, paying taxes, contributing to our country.
In addition to being married to a U.S. citizen, a qualifying immigrant must have lived in the U.S. for 10 years. He or she would then have 3 years to apply for a green card and receive a temporary work permit. And the reaction from two lawmakers?
When someone is married to a U.S. citizen, permitting those families to stay together so that little children don't have to wonder when they go off to school in the morning whether or not mama or daddy will still be there when they get home late in the afternoon.
And frankly, they blame Biden. So I think all these are both him trying to have his cake and eat it too, in the one sense saying he's going to shut the border down, but in the other sense reassuring his progressive left that he's still going to be sensitive to letting people in.
And Catholic Legal Immigration Network, supportive of the moves, writing, Catholic social teaching supports policies that promote family unity, recognizing family as society's primary building block. Earlier this month, the Biden administration halted asylum claims for those arriving between officially designated ports of entry. The White House says that effort has led to fewer border encounters between ports. But Catholic bishops criticized that move, writing, "We strongly urge the president to reverse course and recommit his administration to policies that respect the human life and dignity of migrants, both within and beyond our borders."
Separately tonight, President Biden is off to another campaign event in nearby Virginia. He then heads to Rehoboth Beach, Delaware tonight. And keep in mind the debate between President Biden and former President Donald Trump coming up quick in late June. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
All right, thank you, Owen. And we'll have much more on the anniversary of DACA and the Biden administration's new rules on citizenship for immigration later on in the show. Well, a federal judge granted the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops and two employers in two southern states temporary relief from a federal rule regarding abortion. The measure is from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. It says that a 2022 law to help pregnant workers extends to giving them time off to have an abortion. The USCCB filed a lawsuit, as did attorneys general in Louisiana and in Mississippi. The abortion rules were set to take effect today. A new whistleblower has come forward in the investigation of Boeing. The current Boeing employee claims that the aircraft company tried to shield broken or out-of-date parts from regulators and even lost track of many of those parts. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us now with that story. Eric.
Good evening, Tracy. Yes, the new allegations from the Boeing quality assurance employee Sam Mohawk were highlighted in a 200-page report released Monday by the Democrat majority Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Subcommittee on Investigations. It alleges manufacturing fraud and deception at the 737 MAX final assembly plant in Renton, Washington. It's so bad that the chair of the subcommittee, Senator Richard Blumenthal, is now saying that there is mounting evidence that Boeing should be prosecuted.
This whistleblower, Sam Mohawk, is one of a dozen who have come to us in recent months, and his allegations are extraordinarily serious.
According to the report, Mohawk says Boeing tried to hide non-conforming parts from Federal Aviation Administration regulators by moving them to another location and falsifying records. The whistleblower also claims Boeing was unable to account for many of the parts that it moved around, and those parts may have ended up installed in planes.
As Sam Mohawk reports, the company seems to have continued to put profits and production speed ahead of safety and reliability. And his account of the retaliation against him is particularly chilling. The pressure that was exerted on him to stay silent. They have a program called Speak Up. Well, he was told to shut up.
All this coming out as Boeing's chief executive officer testified today before Congress. Prior to the hearing, Dave Calhoun made a statement.
I'm here to answer questions. I'm here in the spirit of transparency, and I'm here to take responsibility. So that's all for now, and thank you.
What about these new allegations?
During the hearing, Calhoun stood up and apologized to the families who lost loved ones in plane crashes. Lawmakers then grilled Calhoun about the company's safety standards. This is the first appearance before Congress since the January incident when a door plug blew off on the side of a MAX 737 jet in mid-flight.
What are the root causes of this systemic failure? How are you going to fix it? And who should we hold accountable? Does the buck stop with you or with somebody else?
Alaska was a manufacturing defect. I'm not aware of any others that were. And we cannot allow one unsafe airplane to leave our factory.
By the way, the Justice Department has launched a criminal investigation into the Alaska Airlines door panel blowout. Meanwhile, the company also is waiting word on whether it will be criminally prosecuted for fraud in another case. Lawmakers say that they'd also like the DOJ to investigate these new claims by the whistleblowers as well. It's important to note that back in March, Dave Calhoun has already announced that he plans to step down at the end of the year as part of a leadership shakeup. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
An unbreakable relationship of comrades in arms. Those are the words used by North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un to describe his alliance with Russian President Vladimir Putin. In the early morning hours of Wednesday, Putin's plane landed at Pyongyang Airport. The two leaders greeted each other warmly. In previous comments, Putin said that he appreciated Kim's support of his military actions in Ukraine. It has been almost a quarter of a century since Putin visited the Hermit Kingdom. Back in 2000, Putin had just become the Russian president for the first time. Kim's father, Kim Jong-il, was in power, while Kim himself was a teenager. And for more on Putin's visit, let's bring in Sehun Kim, senior correspondent on East and South Asia at Global Stratview. Sehun, always great to be with you. So why do you think this meeting between Putin and Kim, why do you think it's causing so much concern among U.S. officials?
Well, firstly, Tracy, we have to remember that the Russian President Putin is desperate for one thing and one thing alone. It's to essentially prevent Ukraine from joining the NATO and also at the same time combat the Ukrainian front in every way as possible. And so his recent visit to North Korea indicates that he is in a sense desperate to build any type of alliance that is needed. And you have to remember, North Korea has been aiding the Russian Federation on every front, including sending weapons to the Ukraine front for the Russian forces. And so it does look like the alliance itself is also a testament to the world that Putin is willing to do anything in order to win on that front.
Yeah, and Sehun, how does North Korea benefit from this alliance?
Well, it's very simple. North Korea is in a desperate need of raw materials and food supplies. And in exchange, North Korea will provide three things that the Russian Federation really needs at this point. More construction workers. They also will provide any type of weapons that the Russian Federation might need. Probably ballistic missiles and ammunition, for example. And now at this point, we are looking at the great possibility of North Korean foot soldiers being sent to the Ukraine front to fight against the Ukrainian forces to aid Putin's military.
Yeah, and another big concern, too. Experts believe that North Korea has about 50 nuclear bombs, and they've rejected attempts by the U.S. to restart talks. Let's talk about that a little bit more. And the Biden administration, how are they going to navigate this, Sehun?
Well, it's very difficult to say. I mean, at one point, we're fighting against Russia in the Ukrainian front, but also at the same time, Russia has been waging wars in other fronts as well. We saw in Georgia that they're exuding a hybrid war where a national security type of law in Hong Kong was also like, that type of law was actually introduced in Georgia, where Georgia seems to be heading towards becoming another state like Russia. And at the same point, Russia is now expanding its line of influence, a great line of influence in North Korea. And basically, it seems as though it is Putin's message to U.S.'s allies, both South Korea and to Japan, that any type of aid, any type of further aid towards the West's efforts to combat the Russian expansion into Ukraine will be dealt with. I mean, that's something that the Biden administration will have to be mindful of. And again, that's the reason why it is so difficult, because at this point, Putin is in a very desperate spot where he has to win the narrative on the Ukraine, and no matter what. And so the Biden administration will have to be very, very careful in terms of dealing with in Putin at this hour, but also at the same time, be prepared for any type of military escalation in East Asia, including its ongoing efforts in Eastern Europe as well.
Well, Sehun, thank you so much for weighing in. Always appreciate it. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is blaming President Biden for withholding weapons needed for the war in Gaza. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken responded. He says weapons are being sent normally.
I said it's inconceivable that in the past few months, the administration has been withholding weapons and ammunition to Israel. Israel, America's closest ally, fighting for its life, fighting against Iran and our other common enemies. Secretary Blinken assured me that the administration is working day and night to remove these bottlenecks. I certainly hope that's the case.
We, as you know, are continuing to review one shipment that President Biden has talked about with regard to 2,000-pound bombs because of our concerns about their use in a densely populated area. Like Rafah, that remains under review. But everything else is moving as it normally would move, and again, with the perspective of making sure that Israel has what it needs to defend itself against this multiplicity of challenges.
Now, despite questions over Israel's use of U.S. weapons, two top Democrats in Congress have cleared the way for a $15 billion sale of F-15s to Israel. They are set to be delivered by 2029. And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including a path to citizenship. Further analysis on the Biden administration's new plan for spouses of migrants. As mentioned earlier, President Joe Biden took the opportunity today to speak and commemorate the 12th anniversary of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which was enacted by former President Barack Obama in 2012. DACA defers the deportation of migrants who were brought to the U.S. illegally as children. And while the order does not give undocumented immigrants lawful status, the White House says it does allow, in part, quote, young people to live and work in the only country that they have called home. And here to tell us more about that is Stephen Camerata, Director of Research for the Center for Immigration Studies. Stephen, good to be with you today. Want to talk about DACA, but first I want to discuss this new executive action that the Biden administration announced today, which prevents undocumented spouses of U.S. citizens from being deported. Talk to us about the significance of this new policy.
Well, in general, they weren't getting deported anyway if they hadn't committed a crime. So that's not the big change. The big change is that they are getting a status called parole. And that will, after they go through some process, in effect be able to adjust and get green cards. So it is, I think, fair to call it an amnesty for maybe 500,000-600,000 people who are illegal immigrants themselves, but they're married to a U.S. citizen. And as, of course, your listeners may know, if you're married to a U.S. citizen and you're a foreign national, normally you would be able to get a green card. But because these individuals have lived in the United States illegally for an extended period, that creates a problem. And so there are bars for people who've been here illegally to get a green card. And so what this does, in effect, is work around that and effectively give them green cards. They could have gotten green cards if they receive a waiver first, go home to their, you know, where they're from, or at least leave the country and undergo processing, and then would return with a visa and a green card. But this is, in effect, makes it a whole lot easier, a whole lot more attractive for them. So remember, they're not being deported right now. It's just a way of making them, whether they should be is a different question, but it's just a way of making them citizens, giving them a kind of amnesty.
Stephen, do you expect it to face legal challenges like DACA did?
Yes. So there's a whole series of questions. Is the president, for one thing, abusing his parole authority? Is he violating both the spirit and the letter of the law by allowing this kind of way of going around the normal? Congress has set up bans on people who are here illegally adjusting status, though everything with immigration law has an exception. So you have to be careful. But that was Congress's intent, and it would seem that this is an example of the president short-circuiting that. The other thing that I think people will be able to show harm if they're suing is that the Immigration Service is already backlogged. It can't handle all the green card and all the work authorizations and temporary visas, everything that it's being asked to do, and now you're asking it to process 500,000 to 600,000 roles, then they need a waiver so that then they can begin this idea of adjusting status. That too creates a huge workload. So what it means is people, in effect, who are doing it the right way, who are not illegal immigrants, they're going to have to wait a whole lot longer because there's no way the bureaucracy can handle all this because it's already overwhelmed. And this is a very substantial increase in work. And I think that'll be one of the big objections. The two big objections are you're rewarding illegal behavior at a time when we don't want to be encouraging more illegal immigration. And second, it's coming at the expense of people here legally who are going to be pushed to the back of the line, or at least the whole system will really continually grind to a halt, or nearly so.
Yeah, and a lot of people questioning the timing of all this as well. I want to get to DACA really quickly before we run out of time. You know, give us an idea of who these DACA recipients are, the so-called Dreamers, and how many people have benefited from this program since it began in 2012. And there are some issues here as well.
Right. So DACA was for people who came before the age of 16 to the United States. So all of the individuals are basically adults now. A few of them may have been younger, but it didn't work that way. It was mainly just it's all adult people, sometimes in their 20s and 30s, who've lived here for quite some time. We know some other things, that the number of people who have this status has steadily declined, partly because people marry an American or find some other way to get a green card. Some people go home, and there's just natural mortality in a population such as this, as there would be in any. So the number of people with DACA, I think the last numbers I saw was around 600,000. Don't quote me on that. So, and it was several hundred thousand larger originally. But so DACA individuals are, I think it's usually thought to be around 70% from Mexico. So it's very heavily weighted towards Latin America, but they're from all over the world, very heavily weighted towards California. They have modest levels of education. The vast majority, even though they're adults, do not have college degrees. They're not children, as I said, they're all adults. And, you know, they have, as I say, modest levels of education. Some are married to American citizens. Most aren't. So it's not a diverse population ethnically. It's overwhelmingly Latin America, overwhelmingly Mexican, but not exclusively by any means, relatively modestly educated. And it's concentrated in the states you would expect, California and Texas.
All right. Stephen, thank you so much for your insights. Always appreciate it. Great to be with you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the family of a Maryland mother who was killed by an illegal immigrant last year is speaking out against the Biden administration's border policies. Their attorney says the situation at the border needs different solutions.
America is hemorrhaging at the southern border, and the officials in Washington keep arguing over which kind of tourniquet to use. They just can't seem to figure out how to fix this problem. And had they gotten ahead of this and fixed this problem before, Rachel would be alive today.
The suspect in Rachel Morin's killing was arrested last week in Oklahoma. Police say he had been living in the U.S. illegally after killing a woman in El Salvador. He has been charged with the first-degree rape and murder of the 37-year-old mother killed on a hiking trail. Up next on EWTN News Nightly, something extra. We hear from the director of a new documentary on the power of the Eucharist. Learn what is next for the film. Plus, learn about three women buried at St. Peter's Basilica alongside scores of popes. About the Eucharist did so well in its three-day initial release that it is headed back to the theaters for the third time. Jesus Thirst will be re-released starting today until June 26. In its initial three-day release, the movie grossed more than $2.1 million. That puts it in second place for all documentaries released this year. The executive producer says that his greatest hope for the film is that it continues to win souls for Jesus Christ. All right, for more now, we turn to Tim Moriarty, writer, producer, and director of Jesus Thirst. Tim, great to be with you today. A lot to get to, but first, I want to get your reaction to the movie's initial success.
You know, first off, it's great to be here, great to share with your viewers. You know, we've been overwhelmed by the success of the film, by the response of audience members, people who have shared stories of family members, you know, taking another look at the church, saying, you know, maybe it's time to come back home. Maybe it's time to give the Catholic Church a second chance. I think a lot of us over the last few decades have been through some difficult times in the church with scandals, with, you know, looking at statistics of people leaving. This film has been, I think, a really, really welcome piece of art, a film that has stirred hearts to say, wow, you know, what a gift we have in the Catholic faith. And as see it as a real tool and a vehicle to bring about this great Eucharistic revival that we're all working on in the church in the United States.
What have you been hearing from folks who've seen the movie? What have they said to you?
Well, I'll give you a personal example. A friend or a family member actually called right after seeing the film, and she was in tears, and she had been away from the faith, and she said, "This moved me in a way that I wasn't expecting. That this film, leaving the theater, made me wonder, boy, is it possible that God really does come to us in this way? Is it possible that this is what reality really is?" So those kind of responses, precept told us, thank you for, you know, helping me in the work I'm doing, in catechizing my parish. Many bishops have endorsed the film. So again, we really see this as part of Eucharistic revival, that we're leading up to the days before the Congress. This is a way in which all of us can prepare our hearts for something that God is doing in the church here in the United States and around the world.
It's so beautiful, Tim. It really is. What are your plans going forward with Jesus Thirst? I mean, could it be heading back to theaters again after tomorrow?
Indeed. And so this is some of the very exciting news we're here to share, is that due to the success of the film, Fathom has given us these encore dates of June 18th, 19th, but they're also going to extend the run all the way to June 26th. And the purpose here is that people who have not been able to make it on this limited release will have time now to share it with their friends, to share it with family members. This extended release is a great opportunity to really get the word out and work on those grassroots, parish-level sort of communication channels to bring people to this film. For us, there are people who have seen it already and said, well, I'm going to come back, but I'm going to bring a group of friends. I'm going to bring maybe a son and a daughter who've been away from the church for 20 years. That's what I think the gift that we have right now in this opportunity of this extended run, where it's really an invitation for everybody to say, let's celebrate just the great gift we have of Christ truly present in the Eucharist, and let's share it with those who need it most.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for coming on and sharing all this with us. Congratulations on the success. We appreciate it. God bless.
God bless. Thank you so much.
All three women found their resting place inside of St. Peter's Basilica. Thanks to their faith and their courage, they earned the rare honor of being commemorated among the tombs of popes and saints. EWTN Vatican journalist Magdalena Valenskiridi has more.
Not many know that within the silence of the majestic Vatican Basilica, among nearly 100 popes, lie the burial places of three women. Because of their unshakable faith and loyalty to the papacy, Queen Matilda of Tuscany, Queen Christina of Sweden, and Maria Clementina Sobieska-Seward were honored with magnificent funerary monuments inside one of the most important churches in Christianity. Queen Matilda of Tuscany was one of the most influential women of the 11th century, whose life was consumed by the struggle between the church and the state.
Matilda of Tuscany was a very important woman who made the Roman Emperor Henry IV kneel and submit to the power of the Church during those terrible years of tug of war between the power of the Roman Empire and the power of the Catholic Church.
500 years after her death, Pope Urban VIII asked that her remains be brought to Rome and dedicated a monument inside St. Peter's Basilica to her. Below the statue of the Queen, portrait with the scepter of command in her right hand and the papal tiara in the other, lies the sarcophagus with her remains. Queen Christina of Sweden is the second woman honored with a memorial inside the basilica. Her sarcophagus, however, lies in the papal crypt next to the tomb of Benedict XVI. Following scandals over her refusal to marry and, above all, her conversion to Catholicism during the Protestant Reformation, Queen Christina relinquished the throne to her cousin and settled in Rome, making her a powerful symbol of the intellectual freedom of women of her time and of a great victory for the Church.
Sweden is a Protestant nation, and by converting to Catholicism, Christina was forced to abdicate and leave her homeland, following which she came to Rome, where she was received with full honors.
The third woman honored with a memorial inside the Basilica is Maria Clementina Sobieska. The granddaughter of Polish King John III, she married the last Catholic pretender of the English and Scottish throne, James Edward Stuart, putting her in the middle of the struggle for the English throne between Catholics and Protestants. Pope Clement XI, who recognized the couple as the rightful king and queen of England, Scotland and Ireland, granted them a asylum in Rome. Her remains rest in a small tomb on the staircase descending from the roof of the basilica.
She is called the Queen of England, although she never ruled over England. Instead, she lived in Rome in the Square of the Holy Apostles, together with her husband. While her heart was kept in the Basilica of the Holy Apostles, her body was laid to rest here in St. Peter's Basilica.
Although they have no memorials inside the basilica, the remains of three more women are kept in the crypt below the church, those of Santa Petronilla, noblewoman Agnesina Colonna Caetani, and Queen Charlotte of Cyprus.
These must have been women of exceptional value. All of them lived in different periods of time, but they were all very strong, very intelligent, very powerful women that were not afraid of basically showing their intelligence. And they did that fighting for the benefit of the Catholic Church and the Catholic faith.
In Rome, Magdalena Volinskariedi, EWTN News Nightly.
And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.